Good afternoon. It's my pleasure to introduce today's lecturer, Professor Rudy Ebersold from the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Basel. Dr. Ebersold completed his undergraduate and graduate studies in biology at the University of Basel in Switzerland, and then he joined the California Institute of Technology as a postdoctoral fellow and stayed as a senior research fellow until he moved to the University of British Columbia in Vancouver as an assistant professor. In 1993, he moved to the University of Washington, where he was promoted to full professor, and in 2000 left the University of Washington and co-founded the Institute for Systems Biology. In November 2004, he assumed an appointment as professor of systems biology at the Institute of Molecular Systems Biology at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology. It's clear that our understanding of biology beyond the genome requires knowledge of how systems interact, and Rudy has been a pioneer in applying advanced technology toward those objectives. I await with anticipation today's lecture entitled Systems Biology, Network of Networks. Rudy.
Okay, it works. Thanks. Thank you very much, Sandy, for the introduction and also the invitation to come here. It's a pleasure to be here. And I'm very happy to talk about some of our work. It seems there's a bit of feedback here. Right. So I'll first start with a few main points, summarizing a few main points. I will then expand on during the talk. So I think one point that I'm going to try to address is that systems biology starts for the right types of data sets and technologies to generate them. There's clearly a lot of interest in modeling biological processes with mathematical models, but it's also obvious that these models are only as good as the data that are input. And you might say, well, there's plenty of data around, but I want to put emphasis on the right types of data, and I think we'll expand on that later on. Second point I'm going to make is that current proteomics methods are very highly successful in many areas of biology, especially in suggesting new hypotheses. So oftentimes people are doing comparative proteomic analysis of two cells, maybe or a healthy and a tissue from a healthy and a diseased person, and they find differences in these samples, and these differences are then used to formulate some hypotheses to do follow-up experiments. So this is very successful and works very well. There's hundreds of papers published like that a year in the literature. But I will also try to point out then that the current methods are too slow, insensitive, and basically incomplete for systems biology research, which comes back to this point here that we have lots of data, but not the right type of data. And then I will expand or explain with two case studies to illustrate that continued technology development is required, that we need to have better assays to generate specific types of data, and how we can use these type of data. So this is, of course, a slide that is probably very, very well known to everyone here, and it summarizes the predicted genes in the genome of a number of species that have been sequenced over the last decade or so. The big surprise was, of course, that the number of genes in these species is reasonably constant, even though the individuals in these species are able to carry out functions of different complexity. So that the conclusion then was that the biological complexity, the complexity of the functions that these individuals can carry out, is not linearly related to the number of genes. And we take this now as a very common fact and accept it, but even 10 years ago or before the human genome sequence was announced, this was certainly not anticipated by most experts, also genomics experts, because most genomics experts predicted, even before the human genome sequence came out, that the human genome would contain in the order of 100,000 genes or more. So this, of course, creates a dilemma. Namely, we have a number of components, elements, and they carry out functions of various levels of complexity. So how can we explain these different complexity functions with the same number of pieces? And I think this is a fairly insightful quote. This is from Monty Python. It's not related to biology, but they said here, a dictionary contains all the words, so all that Shakespeare had to do was to choose the right number of words and put them into the right order. And I think it reflects fairly nicely the dilemma or the challenge that we're facing in the life science, in biology, in that we have essentially the words or a list of words, the genes and their products. We can predict them in computers. The computer predictions may not be completely accurate, and they're still, of course, fine-tuning. But by and large, I think the word lists are reasonably accurate and predictable. However, we need to figure out how to put these words, the genes and the products in the right order. Basically, we need to understand what the context is. So to me, this is the essence of systems biology, that we need to get from to understand the individual elements, beyond the individual elements and their properties, to understand what their contextual information is. And I think this has been now crystallized out as kind of a working model for systems biology research, that we're dealing here with networks of interacting molecules. And there is a number of specific assumptions that come from that working hypothesis, and that is that the contextual information, namely how these elements interact with each other, how they build a structured networks, that this is the contextual information, and how these networks, as shown here, responds to dynamic perturbations, to stresses, is really what we need to study, and not necessarily the individual components, the nodes in this network. So the assumption is that networks provide insights based on the properties, their structure, and their dynamic behavior that are not apparent from the analysis of the isolated components alone. So the focus of systems biology research, kind of as a working model, is the network as a whole and its dynamic behavior, in addition to, of course, the properties of the individual components in there. So it's kind of a step up in terms of research question from the typical molecular biology question, which is focused on a particular element, a gene or a protein. So I think very briefly to summarize so far, I think we were all, certainly people of my age group, were trained as molecular biologists to focus on specific molecules and their properties. And now, as we are either retrained or trained new in as systems biologists, then we would say we are focusing on networks and their properties, not necessarily on the individual components. So that brings with it a whole range of questions, of course, that ask how can we actually approach these networks and what networks are we actually talking about. So there's many types of biological networks that are intensely being studied these days. I list here a few, and I'm sure anyone here could add a few more to this list. So there's, of course, metabolic networks, networks of enzymes and their substrates, gene regulatory networks, for which there is a huge amount of information already available because a suitable assay had been developed, namely chip experiments, which allow one to measure the relationship between the gene regulatory factors and the gene regulatory sequences. As protein interaction networks, again, a lot of data are available for those, and so on. Generally speaking, I think we can draw from such lists two conclusions. The one is that many or most of these networks contain proteins, or they entirely consist of proteins, such as, for instance, protein-protein interaction networks. So clearly, the analysis of proteins within this research paradigm is an important one. So it's important to also analyze proteins, not exclusively the proteins, but certainly also that we also analyze the proteins. And the other, I think, conclusion that we have to draw is that suitable data collection technologies for many of these networks are still lacking, especially if it comes to obtain complete data sets or dynamic quantitative data sets. We have actually a rather limited repertoire of tools available to study these networks comprehensively and in quantitative terms. So in 2001, Trey Eidecker, who was then a graduate student at the Institute for Systems Biology, published a paper in which he basically laid out a roadmap for experimentation in this systems biology field, which I think largely still being applied and largely still valid. He basically postulated as a general roadmap that the systems biology research research study would have two components, two branches, one an experimental one up here, and one a theoretical or modeling one down here. So he basically postulated that we would initially generate a mathematical model of a pathway or a system that is based on the currently known information, and then predict out of this model the behavior of certain elements, for instance, the proteins, protein interactions, and whatever the case might be. In parallel, one would measure the in cells that contain the system under study. One would do measurements of differentially perturbed cells and then do the appropriate measurements and determine whether the predicted patterns and the measured patterns would fit. If they did not fit, one would go another round, do more perturbation, more measurements, and more computation here until one would reach a reasonable convergence of the experimental data with the predicted data here. So if we apply this research principle or roadmap to any particular systems biology question, we have to request certain qualities of the data that are useful or necessary to feed such a cycle. So this is to highlight systems requirement that requirement for data sets in systems biology is fundamentally different from the quality of data or the properties of data that we might want to use in other research conditions. First, we need to measure the complete. We need to do complete measurements. That is, every network element should be measured in each measurement. So, because if we don't do that, if we go through this iterative cycle of perturbation measurement, and every time we only sample a small subset of the observable events, then of course it will be very difficult to get sufficient data density to reach a complete understanding of the model. Secondly, we need to be able to do serial measurements to detect contextual information, which means it has to be fast, and we need to be able to do this at reasonably high throughput. We should have non-error models, which is very important for feeding data into a model, and the data should be accurately quantitative. So these are properties that are fairly obvious to obvious requirements. However, they're reasonably hard to achieve, and in the field of proteomics, they're not actually achievable with current techniques. So I will explain that a little further. What actually the limitations are currently of the current proteomic techniques as we go along in two examples. I would now like to describe two examples that illustrate how new technology development is necessary, the current status to that of these particular approaches, and then I'll show an example in each case that shows how applicable the techniques currently already are. So I chose two examples, one in a network that is very well mapped out, where there's a huge amount of prior knowledge, so we are already at a stage where a mathematical model that is reasonably accurate can be formulated, and where the additional data are used to refine the model to get a more complete understanding. And the case here is central carbon metabolism in yeast. And then I show a second example, which is a very different case, where we talk about a network where virtually nothing is known, and we are at a stage where we need to start mapping out this network basically from scratch, and that is the network of protein kinases and their substrates. So in both cases, I will first show what techniques are being developed to address this question, and then show how they work. So the central carbon metabolism in yeast has been studied for many years, of course, initially by biochemists, then by the genomics, for instance, expression rate techniques. And this is a map here which is not particularly informative. It should just indicate that it's a confined system, well-defined, with lots of connections already known, and with many of the elements that constitute the system already known as well. So we assumed, or we concluded from literature, that there's 115 proteins involved in this network, and the abundance of these proteins based on current knowledge ranges from 238 copies per cell to about 1 million copies per cell. So it spans a fairly large range of the abundance level of a yeast cell. And now if you want to implement this paradigm of experimentation, namely perturbation measurement, we would need to have a proteomic technique which allows us to measure in each perturbed state all these proteins in this very broad dynamic range of expression, and to measure them all every time and to get accurate quantitation in each case. So this is not possible with current techniques. At least it is very difficult to achieve. So the challenge is to obtain quantitatively accurate data on all the proteins in the network in multiple metabolic states of the cell. So why is it not possible today with the current techniques? So this illustrates a map which is produced by a modern mass spectrometer, which is applied to do shotgun proteomics. Basically, you isolate the proteins, you digest the proteins, and then infuse the peptide sample into the mass spectrometer, which samples the available peptides and sequences as many as possible. So this is a display of a result of such an experiment, where we have here retention time, which is a time axis for how the peptides elute from the column, and in the y-axis we have the mass of the peptides that are coming out. So we see here a lot of features. We see black features, we see blue features, and red features. So what I can describe what they mean. So the black features are those that are detected by the mass spectrometer as a signal. So these are peptides which are detected, but are not nothing further happens to them. So they're simply recorded as a precursor ion, but they're not actually followed up by the mass spectrometer. The blue features are those that are detected by the mass spectrometer, but also selected for fragmentation. So these are the precursor ions. These are the features which the mass spectrometer tries to identify because it selects them for a collisional fragmentation, induced fragmentation, and then records a fragment ion spectrum. The red features are those where this attempt is actually successful, where the fragment ion spectrum that's being generated is correctly assigned to a peptide sequence in the proteome of that particular species. So if you look in a little bit of an enlarged view here, this is basically just an expanded view. We see now why the task we pose for systems biology-oriented proteomics is not really solvable right now with this shotgun method, because we see that there is a fairly large number of features that are not not attempted for sequencing. There's some that are attempted for sequencing but don't succeed, and the number of features that are actually detected and correctly identified is only a fraction of the available features that are present in the sample. So now even more compounding the problem is, if we did exactly the same analysis again, the distribution of red and blue features on the black ones would be somewhat different. That means we would sample out of the pool of peptides a different subset and correctly identify a different subset. So this, of course, precludes us, the incomplete coverage here and the somewhat random selection precludes us from obtaining a complete data set if we do repeat analysis, let's say, on differentially perturbed cells. So this basically led us to suggest and now to largely implement a reversible of the strategy of proteomics. Rather than allowing the mass spectrometer to randomly sample the features that are present in the sample, we suggest that we would basically follow what genomics has already done, namely map out the available space once, and map out the proteome once with a considerable amount of effort, and then use the information from these proteome maps to set up assays which are quantitatively accurate and can be done with very low redundancy to measure those proteins we want to measure. Basically, we propose to convert proteomics from a shotgun approach in a targeted measurement approach. And we propose this by doing the following. We select from libraries of proteomic maps, which one of them is the peptide atlas that we develop at the ISB. We propose to select from this peptide atlas database lists of ions, precursor ions, of about in the order of magnitude of 1,000 per experiment, and then to do targeted measurements, basically use the mass spectrometer to target specifically the sample for this list of ions that we want to measure, and the mass spectrometer will detect and quantify these sets of proteins that we predetermine. So it's going from a shotgun to a hypothesis-driven experiment by using targeted mass spectrometry. So this is the idea. We now proposed this a while back and now worked on it for a while, and I can now show some data to indicate how it works and then show an application. The method that is the mass spectrometric method that is ideally suited for this task is referred to multiple reaction monitoring or also selected reaction monitoring depending on the nomenclature one is using. This is carried out in a relatively mature mass spectrometer, triple quadrupole mass spectrometer or quadrupole trap mass spectrometer, and it is essentially a two-stage filtering process that is carried out in these instruments. The first level of filtering happens in the first quadrupole here, where the mixture of ions that is being generated and the ion source here is filtered, and only ions that have a particular predetermined mass range that is usually very narrow, 1 to 3 mass units wide, are selected further on, and everything else is filtered out. So here we select at the level of the precursor ion and relatively narrowly, and we select only those peptides, ions, that actually have the suitable precursor mass. Everyone who is selected here is then fragmented in the collision cell, generating fragment ions, and then the second filtering occurs is that the third quadrupole here only is only fixed on those fragment ions which are typical for the targeted precursor ion. So even if you have multiple precursor ions here in this collision cell that fragment, it is unlikely that they will also generate fragment ions that are typical for the targeted peptide. So the fragment ions from anyone else, any contaminant, or any non-intended peptide is basically tuned out, and the mass spectrometer spends all its time recording the signal intensity of those fragment ions which are typical and coming from the targeted precursor. So it's a two-stage filtering, first at the precursor level, secondly at the fragment ion level, and that gives us an enormous sensitivity and actually a very good range of a dynamic range. So for those who are not really interested in mass spectrometry, you can think of that as the mass spectrometer's ELISA test. Namely, it's a test where you have a sample and you use a test, in this case a mass spectrometer, not an antibody test, but you ask how much of a particular target analyte, in this case a peptide that indicates the presence of a protein, is present in my sample. Except that we can do this in a fairly highly multiplexed fashion, as I will show. So first we wanted to ask how sensitive is actually this method, because when we say we want to do complete measurements of all the elements of a biological system, we would need to be able to detect most or all the proteins in a cell. So again, this is work from Paola Picotti, a postdoc in the laboratory, and she took the only credible abundance list, absolute abundance list for proteins for any species that I know of, and that's from this paper from Jonathan Weissman and Erin O'Shea, where they used Western blotting or in fact GFP tagged proteins to measure the abundance of a large number of proteins in the yeast cell in absolute terms. So they identified the absolute quantities from about a bit more than 4,000 proteins. And so Paolo binned these proteins, the abundances of these proteins, into bins of log 2. So the ones that are present about 500,000 to a million, down to proteins present below 128 copies a cell. And from each one of these bins, she chose 5 proteins and then asked, if she set up this targeted mass spectrometry experiment, this MRM assays for each one of these proteins, she wanted to ask how far down can she see into the proteome by this method. So she used 2 attempts. One is the whole protein digest, And one is an additional fractionation by off-gel electrophoresis, which is basically an isoelectric focusing technique. I will not talk about that, but from here, from a total digest to here, one gains approximately another order of magnitude in sensitivity. So these are the bins that were used. So these are the proteins from about a million to below 128. These are a number of proteins in these bins. And then she included also several groups which are of somewhat interesting. This is a group, this is not detected by the, was not expressed in the Weismann paper. This is a group of proteins which is not quantifiable because it had low signal range in the Weismann paper. This is a group of proteins which are not quantifiable for other reasons. And this is a group of proteins which have never been observed before, neither by the GFP tagging method nor by any mass spectrometric method. So all these proteins were measured in this MRM assay, and basically all of them were identified. So she can cover the whole range from more than a million copies per cell down to proteins expressed as low as 41 copies per cell based on these quantitative measurements. We have additional step of about an order of magnitude in sensitivity to gain by doing an isoelectric focusing step before, which would bring us down to essentially single copy, single digit not copies per cell. And we can also see that this is probably somewhat interesting, that the copies per cell estimated or measured by the Western blotting or FACS sorting techniques using GFP are in reasonably good agreement with the copies measured in the mass spectrometer. So this basically means that we can cover in a single experiment the proteins covering, at least for a dynamic range of a yeast cell proteome, roughly the whole range. For a human cell, that might be, of course, a bit different. We haven't actually done that yet for human cells, but one would expect that it would be somewhat different, more difficult for human cells because the range may be larger and also the complexity may be a bit larger than in a yeast cell. So now, this one could say, well, this is all fine if one can do an assay to very low levels of detection, but can we also multiplex that? And there we have a problem with this technique, in that there's a trade-off between the sensitivity achieved and the number of transitions that are measured. Transitions are the relationships from between the fragment ion of a particular peptide to its precursor ion. So it's a transition from a precursor ion to the fragment ion that is basically measured in this two-stage filtering, and this is referred to commonly as a transition. So the trade-off is illustrated in this slide here. So let's assume we do a chromatography experiment, and the peak here indicates a peak of a peptide eluting from the column, and the elution time will be in the range of 20 to 30 seconds or something like that. So, of course, every time such a transition is measured, it consumes some time. And when we were to measure 10 transitions with a dwell time, so the time the mass spectrometer sitting on a particular transition is 50 milliseconds, then it would consume about half a second, which is small in relation to the chromatography. So we clearly have no problem with measuring 10 transitions in such an experiment. But if we go up to want to measure 500 transitions, and we would use 50 milliseconds of dwell time, then this time becomes large, the time consumed becomes large, compared to the chromatography elution time, because we might only have one or even zero time points over the elution time of the peak. And then, of course, the quantification becomes extremely inaccurate, because you might not know whether if you only have one peak, whether you measure down here, or whether you measure actually down here at the apex of the peak. So to get accurate quantification, one needs to be able to have multiple measurements over the chromatographic elution time of a peak, which limits, in principle, the number of transitions that can be measured in a single experiment, and therefore the number of peptides that can be measured. So we attempted to overcome this by a very simple trick that is now implemented, and this is now actually in the literature, where we simply concatenated the runtime here of the of the chromatography system into multiple segments, and we can now in each segment have a number of transitions that are being predetermined and measured, and then immediately when this segment is over, the next one starts with an entirely new set of transitions to be measured. So we basically concatenate a number of mini experiments into a larger experiment that has about the duration of a typical chromatography run. And with this very simple trick, which actually needed a lot of cooperation from the company that produces the mass spectrometer, and that's why the scientist from the company is the first author on this paper, is we achieved now that we can measure about 1,000 transitions per runtime, and we need to measure for each peptide to be sure that we have the right peptide about 2 to 3 or maybe in 4 transitions. But the upshot is that in a single run here, we can measure the quantify and detect the, and determine the presence of approximately 200 to 300 peptides in a sample, down to a level of sensitivity of a few copies per cell in yeast. I would like to illustrate how this works and how powerful this actually is as an approach to generate data for systems biology. And I chose an example here which is a very famous experiment, and it's referred to as dioxic shift in yeast. So the dioxic shift is an experiment where yeast cells are grown in glucose, which is a preferred carbon source for them, and then they let to grow in this carbon and basically in glucose, and they grow, and while they grow, of course, they consume glucose, so we don't add any glucose to the sample, and eventually they will consume all the glucose, which is their preferred food, and then they go through a transition phase because now their preferred food is no longer available. And of course, we know from basic biology that while yeast is metabolizing glucose, they produce ethanol. So the culture medium will over time decrease in the glucose concentration and increase in the ethanol concentration. And there is a shift here when the cell senses that the preferred food source is running out. And then it will switch its metabolism to start consuming ethanol, and you will see this here, that there's a lag in the growth phase, and then the cells start growing again, now using ethanol as their food source. So it's a shift, basically a shift in metabolism from consuming glucose to consuming ethanol. So the experiment here was, and we chose this experiment because there's very good expression array data. In fact, this was one of the first experiments that was done when Pat Brown developed the gene expression array technology. They did exactly this type of experiment to show the dynamics of the system at that time at the level of the messages. And so we thought it was a good idea to follow these measurements with measurements at the level of the proteins. So the experiment basically is to take time points here or sample the culture at various time points to measure all the proteins in this yeast metabolic proteome and try to figure out how the system behaves. So we measure, so this is basically what I just said. We measure the glucose growth, the ethanol growth, and transition phase in between, and we measure the presence and absence and quantitative differences in the proteins that constitute that network. So there's a total of 112 metabolic proteins were measured with 6 points, and now we obtain, because we use this targeted approach, complete quantitative series for each one of these proteins, and this just shows how the data look like here. It's not particularly informative. Each peak here is basically a peptide that's detected, and you might say, well, there is overlapping peaks, but of course it doesn't matter because the chromatography time is only one dimension. The other much more informative dimension is the mass spec transitions that are being measured, and of course you can have multiple convoluting, and the instrument can deconvolute that. So all these proteins are measured, or peptides from these proteins are measured in the same operation, and what we can then plot for each protein is a curve, an abundance curve. So here we see a protein, for instance, alcohol dehydrogenase, which decreases steadily. Here we see a protein that is not present or not detectable at the beginning, then in the transition phase shoots up, and so on. So we can summarize this data in a plot or in a figure, and this is the color-coded figure where each enzyme of the system is labeled as a box, and the color coding is that in the glucose to ethanol growth condition, the green proteins will be upregulated, the blue, the ochre, what's that, the brown proteins will be downregulated, and the intensity of the stain of the dye will say how strongly the upregulation is. We can also read that in numbers here. Of course, for each measurement point, we have a quantification that is fairly accurate. So that these are extremely useful data for feeding into a model, which now has happened, and we now, in collaboration with Uwe Sauer, trying to refine the metabolic model by, for the first time, using complete quantitative data, proteomic data that feed into the model. And I just want to make one additional point here, that we also have the ability to differentiate between isozymes or isoforms if these isozymes contain peptides that differ in their sequence. This is actually a challenging task and probably an important task because yeast cells and also other species produce a number of isozymes that ostensibly carry out the same function. So, for instance, there's two hexokinases, one and two. There is five alcohol dehydrogenases, and of course the enzymes carry out the same biocatalytic function, but they might not all do it under the same conditions. So if we now in a systems biology paradigm, we are interested in the context, we would like to know, can we distinguish the quantitative behavior of these isozymes in an experiment like the dioxic shift experiment? So we can do that because we could find a peptide for each one of these proteins, minimally one peptide, with exception of this protein here and this protein here, where we find a peptide that distinguishes the various isoforms. So now you might say, well, that's interesting, but what do we learn? It's actually fairly informative what we find. So this is an example of where we measured where there's two isozymes of phosphofructokinase, one and a two isozyme, and they show reasonably similar quantitative behavior over that dioxic shift experiment. So this is actually plausible because it's known from the literature that these two proteins form a heterodimer, so they are kind of expected to show the same quantitative pattern. In contrast, we could measure the behavior of hexokinase 1 and hexokinase 2. Again, two isozymes which perform the same catalytic function, but obviously they are under different regulation, transcriptional or post-transcriptional regulation, because the one isozyme starts low, shoots up in the transition phase, and then decays again, and the other one slowly decays over the whole cycle of a dioxic shift experiment. So none of this information has ever been captured for a model of the yeast metabolism. So this is clearly new information we need to figure out, or the mathematicians need to figure out how these data are factored in, because it's not just hexokinase. One would have to resolve this in the level of the isozyme and then try to understand why and by what mechanisms these isozymes are differentially regulated. So there's a lot of information we can obtain by this type of data, by this type of experiments. But of course, we need to first establish these quantitative assays. So we need to know from which protein, which peptide is actually a good target, and we need to know which fragment ion precursor ion to fragment ion transition is an optimized transition for each peptide. So we started to assemble this data for yeast. The goal is that we will have basically a mass spec MRM assay published or available as a downloadable resource for every yeast protein. We're not there yet, but we have assays for about 1,500 proteins, which can be easily downloaded now. And we're going to make this public very soon. So this is part of the Peptide Atlas project that is going on at ISB as part of the Heartland Lung Institute funded Proteome Center. So the idea is that for eventually, and that's not going to take very long, that for every yeast protein, we will have a downloadable mass spec quantitative mass spec assay on the web. So if some biologist who's working in yeast says, I'm interested in something else than carbon metabolism, let's say in pheromone signaling, we could go in and say, I'm interested in this set of proteins, maybe 500 proteins. And then the system will tell the person which transitions need to be dialed into the mass spectrometer to carry out a quantitative mass spec experiment for these proteins, kind of like an antibody resource that might be generated if one were going to do these similar measurements using affinity-based reagents. So to summarize that part, what I try to show here is I try to show an example from a case where the network is already largely mapped out. We know most or all of the parts, and really the information that we want to obtain is how these elements relate to each other and how they quantitatively change over the duration of an experiment or in response to certain perturbations. I think in the future this will be very common, that we have sufficient amount of basic information about the basic wiring diagram, and this will be a very common experiment that we want to simply measure the quantitative behavior of the parts. And we think we can do that by this targeted mass spectrometry paradigm, especially if the resources become available to actually generate these transitions first, and they can simply be downloaded and implemented in the instrument, so the assay development is already done. And then, so we think this is a sensible way to go, and I try to show with this dioxic shift experiment that we can observe dynamic change of the whole network. We can resolve isozymes and show different quantitative behavior for them. And one thing I didn't show for reason of time, we can also detect changes in phosphorylation state of the individual proteins. In fact, there's a lot of phosphorylation going on in these metabolic enzymes, which is also something that has been largely unexplored, even though metabolism, especially in yeast, of course, has been studied for many decades. So then the last point I made here was the PET-ED Atlas project that contains a transition atlas to support targeted mass spectrometry. And this has to be further populated with data, but I think it's relatively straightforward to do that over the next half year or so, especially in yeast. So the second example I would like to show is a very different case. And here we are dealing with a network, which is also, of course, important biologically, but for which is very little is known. So we would like to map out protein kinases and their substrates again in yeast before we eventually might migrate to human cells. So the situation is as follows. Of course, everyone knows that reversible protein phosphorylation is a universal regulatory mechanism of the cell. There's hundreds or thousands of studies which deal with phosphorylation of specific proteins or the regulation of specific kinases. But however, for most protein kinases, few or no confirmed substrates are presently known. The relationship between kinases, their associations, biological processes, and how they are regulated in turn is also largely unknown. And I believe that if we want to reach comprehensive modeling of any process, we will likely require the inclusion of dynamic phosphorylation data, because it clearly is a universal and very important regulatory process. There's very few models currently that involve any phosphorylation data. Maybe the exception is the models that are emerging for cell cycle, which have some specific phosphorylation events already annotated or used. Because, of course, there has been a lot of phosphorylation studies have been done with specific kinases in the cell cycle. So the attempt that we are undertaking is conceptually simple. In practice, it's difficult, and it required, again, an adaptation of the proteomic strategy, and we came up with a different strategy for a problem like that. So here we would create first the strains of yeast which lack a particular kinase. We actually don't have to do that because it's been done by the yeast community. And there is yeast deletion strains available that are accessible to us. So the idea was we would take each one of these yeast deletion strains plus wild type. We would isolate the phosphorylated peptides, basically generate using a mass spectrometer for each deletion strain, a fingerprint of phosphopeptides that are detected and isolated from these deletion strains in the wild type. We would then do differential pattern analysis and basically relate these patterns from each strain to each other and try to find out which peptides are disappearing when the kinase activity is disappeared. And we would then hope that eventually we would identify these peptides and relate and then use this data to generate a network of kinases and their substrates. So that's the goal, and that's the general work process. So you might appreciate that this is a lot of work because we need this more than 100 kinases. We need to, for each one, generate these phosphopeptide patterns, and if we were to extensively sequence these peptides for each of these kinases, it would take forever or at least very long time. So we need a high throughput measurement where we can generate these patterns and relate them to each other, and we achieve that by basically label-free quantitative proteomics based on pattern matching. So this is based on a computer program that was developed by Lucas Müller, who was a graduate student in our lab. He calls it SuperHin, and the output of it is something he calls a master map, and I briefly explain how this works. So we will generate from each sample, in this case a yeast deletion strain, pattern, retention time versus mass versus intensity of specific features. These are phosphopeptides extracted from the cells. And we would do that for each cell type deletion strain, and then we relate these patterns to each other using pattern matching, and in every time, as I showed very early on in the talk, every time we do that, a number of the features are also sequenced and identified, but not all of them. So then the software tool also tracks the features that are identified in any one of these panes here, in any one of these samples, and it tracks them, projects them on a master map, which is basically a composite of the peptide features which are identified and or simply detected in any one of the samples. And with each one of these features here in the master map, we also have the identity if it's been sequenced and the quantitative behavior over the comparison of multiple samples. So that's what the software tool does. Then we built another software tool where this SuperHin is a part. So this is referred to as the Cora framework. This is work by Miyun Brusniak, which just submitted for a publication. He basically uses this SuperHin software tool as a matching tool and builds it in a larger environment where we basically can take multiple LCMS patterns, retention time versus mass patterns, pick the features, align the LCMS maps and compare them. And then also there's a lot of software related to the identification of the features, and there is a lot of statistical tools which allow us to visualize and validate the differentially expressed or differentially present features. So basically what this whole software environment allows us to do is to generate is to take the LCMS patterns, to find features, compare them to each other, and then identify the features and know what peptide sequence is associated with them. This is a number of ways to display the data, and I'm just showing that because we'll come back to these volcano plots, which is an indication of differentially regulated or differentially abundant features, each in a volcano plot as I show here. Each dot here is a peptide, and the x-axis indicates the quantitative difference of this particular peptide between two samples, and the y-axis indicates the reliability, the quality of this point, so that we have a lot of confidence that this peptide actually was correctly detected. So we were looking always for peptides up here, which are strongly up or strongly down-regulated in which we have high confidence. So we'll see some of these plots later on. So that's all part of this Cora suite. So we have now established the tool that we can take from each yeast strain, basically a snapshot, which only takes now about an hour or an hour and a half. And we can take for phosphopeptides and we can relate them to each other to find differentially regulated features. Now, what if a feature has not actually been identified yet? So Alex Schmidt, who is another postdoc in the group, developed a directed mass spectrometry workflow which allows us to go in and sequence those peptides which have shown interesting quantitative behavior but have not been identified in any experiment before. So this is basically what I showed before. We have multiple samples. We align them with the SuperHen algorithm. We generate these volcano plots. We will focus then on these features up here which have never been identified. And then we want to sequence them by targeted sequencing. And the way this is carried out is now working actually quite well. And this is a very powerful method, is that the features which are found by the differential software tool are encoded into master table of features, basically retention time versus mass table. And then we have developed a software tool which fragments this master table into specific inclusion lists, which are going into the mass spectrometer, and the mass spectrometer will then do in sequential run of the same sample, basically focus its sequencing effort on those peptides which are on the inclusion list, namely those which show an interesting behavior and have never been identified before. So we can generate multiple patterns. We can compare these patterns quantitatively. We can then extract the features that are differentially regulated and sequence them by targeted sequencing. So this just shows that this is a very effective method to go after very small peaks. So this is a chromatogram where we have large peak here. This is not interesting. The small ones here is interesting, which is very, very low intensity, can still be identified by targeted sequencing. But if we were to do top-down, or if we were to do let the mass spectrometer decide what to sequence, you would never get to this small peak. It would always sequence the high-intensity peaks first. It's just to show that this is an effective method. Now for this yeast, for this kinase substrate project, we also need to know whether we can reliably extract phosphopeptides. Because you cannot really run a total yeast lysate any total lysate through a mass spectrometer and assume that we identify phosphopeptides from a total lysate, we need to enrich for them to detect them reliably. So we needed to ask, can we reproducibly identify the phosphopeptides of a cell? So this is an experiment where we tried to answer this question. It happens to be in fly cells, it doesn't really matter, it's the same for yeast. The proteins were isolated, digested, and then we used, this is work from a graduate student, Bernd Bodenmiller, he used four different ways that have been published to enrich for phosphorylated peptides. One is well-known metal affinity chromatography method. One is a method we developed, which is based on phosphoramidite chemistry. It covalently captures phosphopeptides, and then they can be released from a bead again. And there's two versions of titanium dioxide. These isolated phosphopeptides were analyzed with the mass spectrometer using exactly this SuperHen algorithm, and we simply asked, can we reproducibly identify the peptides, and is each method identifying the same or different subset of peptides, and is the isolation specific? So this is a result from this study, which was published last year. It's basically a heat map where the patterns from one isolation method, five repeats of one isolation method were aligned with five repeats of the other and with any other isolation method. So the surprising result here was that in every case, whether we use metal affinity chromatography, phosphoramidite, or titanium, the isolation works, it's reproducible, and actually quite effective, but there is substantially different subsets of the proteome, and phosphoproteome is isolated by the respective methods. So we conclude that if we would want to get a reasonably complete overview over the phosphoproteome, then we would need to apply in parallel on the same sample minimally two or three of these isolation methods. So the question always comes up, what's the difference? And we have some ideas. I mean, there's some patterns which emerge, which are more strongly enriched by one method versus the other. But largely, I think we have to say this is empirical and not really well understood. But I think the data are fairly clear and have now also been observed by many others in the meantime. So we basically have a method here now to tempt this relatively ambitious kinase to substrate mapping projects. We have a proteomic method which allows us to relatively quickly compare multiple samples to identify the differential features, and we have a method, or several methods actually, which allow us to reproducibly isolate phosphorylated peptides from total cell lysates and to reliably and reproducibly analyze them. So now I want to show again an example. I cannot show example from the whole network because we don't have that yet. We're about halfway through with the measurements, but I want to show a few an example with one of the kinase deletion strains, and then point out the type of information we can already gain, and it's actually, I think, a fascinating undertaking. The enzyme I chose here was YCK, the yeast casein kinase, and the experiment was to generate wild-type strain extracts, YCK1 deletion strain extracts. We do always three repeat isolates with the various various isolation methods, and then we generate with each sample one of these master maps, and they are compared, and we look for differentially regulated features. So this one map contains about information about 1,400 proteins to about 50 copies per cell. So first question, of course, do the two patterns look differently? This is simple cluster analysis. We see that the three repeat isolates of the deletion strain cluster together more closely, relatively closely. The three repeat patterns from the wild-type strain cluster together relatively closely and more closely than between the groups. So that means it's working in the sense that the patterns are reproducible and are distinguishable. Second control we have that show that the system works is because, fortunately, YCK1, the kinase itself, is phosphorylated by another kinase. So if the kinase is deleted and the mass spectrometer finds differences in the deletion strain, it should, of course, find the peptide from YCK as a differential feature, and it does. So here is the wild-type strain, which is a strong peptide here present, which is absent, and this is exactly the peptide that is phosphorylation site on the YCK kinase. In fact, there's three of them, and it finds all three. So that means that it can at least those differences that it should find, it does find. It's again a system test. So then we asked, is there any on-off phenomena which we would expect? Namely, if the kinase is present, you would expect that the substrates are phosphorylated. If the kinase is absent, you would assume that the direct phosphates are not phosphorylated. So these are on-off phenomena, and we see here that with this volcano plot that there is peptides that show this behavior. We also see that is peptides present which show the opposite behavior. That means if the kinase is absent, their phosphorylation is induced. So this is actually was initially puzzling. We now see that with every kinase we looked at, and I think it shows that there is the cell attempts, when the kinase is absent, it attempts to compensate in ways which are not clear how it works, but it tries to compensate, and this compensation leads to the increase of phosphorylation sites that are detectable by this approach. Okay, so this is what we detect, and now we want to ask, what can we learn from these features? Of course, each dot here is a phosphopeptide that is absent when the kinase is absent, and we know the sequence of this phosphopeptide. So we want to ask, can we identify direct phosphopeptide substrates, kinase substrates, and we do that by invoking a lot of additional information that includes experiments done by Mike Snyder's lab, where they do in vitro kinase reactions. We use synthetic rescue, synthetic lethal screens, and we use additional information that's available, including the consensus recognition sequence of this kinase. So every feature, so I explained what this figure means. Every feature on here is a peptide that is disappearing when the YCK kinase disappears. The ones that are yellow coded here are those among all these features disappearing that contain the consensus recognition sequence that is attributed to the casein kinase. And the blue arrows here, which are a little hard to see, are those peptides that were also identified by Mike Snyder's screen. So, for instance, this one here would be a peptide that has a consensus recognition sequence identified in this mass spec screen, and it's also identified by Mike Snyder's in vitro screen. So that's a relatively good bet that this actually, but no proof, of course, that is a direct substrate. So we try to, and that's ongoing work, we try to invoke multiple levels of information to combine this information to try to filter out those peptides phosphocytes which might be direct targets of the particular kinase. So that's one attempt we try to do. A second question we would like to answer is what process might the particular kinase be involved? And the argument here would be that if we find phosphopeptides which are genuine or at least highly likely substrates of that kinase, we can ask which protein functions are these proteins associated with. And we see here a nice example. In that YCK1, phosphorylates peptides here, or, well, I should say if YCK1 is not present, these phosphopeptides disappear. All of these phosphopeptides disappear, but the yellow ones here are all associated with vesicle-mediated transport. So we would assume from this data, and there's many other such examples that I, of course, don't have time to show, that if YCK kinase is absent, these peptides or proteins which are related to this process are no longer phosphorylated, and there's an enrichment of proteins with that function in that set of proteins identified in this screen. So we assume that YCK1 is involved in vesicle-mediated transport as a process. So the third question we try to answer is, can we start building up indirect phosphorylation events, basically indirect phosphorylation cascades, from this large-scale data? And there is, an example. It's just an example of one of many, where we show here is, again, YCK1. We know that YCK1 phosphorylates another kinase, PTK2, and all the yellow features here are those peptides that disappear when YCK1 is deleted. So, but only the ones which have a pink arrow here are those peptides which also have a consensus recognition sequence. So we assume and we infer from that YCK1 phosphorylates PTK2, another kinase. It's an indirect effect. It also phosphorylates some of these proteins here, but the majority of these yellow proteins associated here or localized around PTK2 are actually substrates of PTK2, and the reason they're no longer detected when YCK1 is absent is because it's an indirect effect, because this kinase is no longer activated. So we think that by doing this measurement systematically and doing a lot of data manipulation, data searching later on, we will actually be in a position to establish a protein kinase substrate interaction network that is going to contain a lot of information, although we are clearly not at the stage where to do that right now. We have now the data collected of more than half of the yeast kinase strains, and the rest will be collected over the next few months, and we can, of course, cluster them. Well, I skipped that because I got a sign from Sandy that I should running out of time. So the idea here was to generate a network of protein kinases and their substrates. The approach was to take the yeast deletion strains, generate these master maps, relate them to each other, and then do a lot of data processing in between. And what I hope to show is that to achieve this goal, we had again to develop a different proteomic approach. The classical shotgun approach would not suffice, again, because it's not complete. The data set is not complete and it's way too slow. And we think by this quantitative label-free proteomic experiments, we have the throughput to actually tackle an experiment of the size. So in this, just to finish off here, we again, as in the MRM case, we try to generate a data resource which will be accessible and useful for the community. We call this PhosphoPEP. It's a database which contains the phosphopeptide information, but also a lot of associated research data, software tools, this which allow us to create hypotheses which proteins might be observed and measurable, allow us to design experiment, and then to validate the data either using a label-free quantitative experiment or to do an MRM experiment, as I showed before. So basically, it's a map of phosphorylated date, phosphopeptides identified to date in various species. So this it has an instance of Drosophila, which is with about 12,000 phosphocytes, about 8,000 phosphocytes from Cerevisiae, about 5,000 from C. elegans, and about 5,000 from human so far, and the data will increase very rapidly. So we could ask, with this resource, which phosphopeptides have been observed from your protein of interest. For instance, that's one of the queries that, of course, the system supports. So to summarize here, what I tried to show in this second example, that substrate kinase networks and their dynamic change are essential dimension for data for systems biology, that the comparison of these phosphopeptides from wild type and perturbed cells is highly informative in many ways, and try to show that we can detect direct substrates, we can detect indirect substrates, we can find functional involvement of the kinase in a particular process, and we're about halfway there right now. So I'd like to finish here. What I try to show is that in systems biology research, we have different requirements for the data. The data should be quantitative, should be complete data sets on the whole system, and that we need new approaches, which are to some extent established now, to generate such data. And finally, I would like to acknowledge my collaborators whose work I presented. This is Paul Shannon and Hector Ramos at the ISB, who work on the data processing for this yeast deletion strain data. Bernd Bodenmiller, who creates the yeast deletion strain data. Lucas Müller and Markus Müller work on the SuperHin and MasterMap software tool. Paola Picotti, Vince Lange, and Anne Kimmel, and the group of Uwe Sauer worked on this dioxic shift experiment. And Paola Picotti and Bruno Domon implemented together with also Vince Lange the targeted mass spectrometry workflow. The whole enterprise is supported by a group of software engineers and algorithm developers at the ISB, whose name is shown here, and who, of course, provide a lot of the underlying software environment. So I'd like to stop here. I'm happy to answer questions.
Give us the sensitivity as the numbers of molecules per cell. I assume that you have used many cells for getting that. In multicellular organisms, however, one would like to have information perhaps from from particular cells in a tissue or even from single cells. What are your feelings about the sensitivity in absolute numbers?
Yeah. Okay, So the question is how many cells do we need to get to that sensitivity? So that depends on the cell type. What the fixed point is that what goes the amount of sample that goes onto the analytical system, the chromatography, is approximately 2 to 3 micrograms of total peptide. So you could translate that into numbers of cells in your particular case. And then one, of course, we need to factor in a bit of loss because the cells have to be ground up and digested and the peptides have to be run over as a C18 column, but it's not a very large number of cells.
You did some very nice experiments in creating inclusion.
Sorry, I can't hear what you say.
I said, have you tried using your inclusion lists as exclusion lists and seeing what molecules you identify? Possibly searching for any novel post-translational modifications?
Okay, I have a hard time understanding the question. So you said something about the inclusion list and the exclusion list. Did you understand, Sandy?
Have you tried reversing the inclusion list? But I'm not sure for what objective.
So I'm sorry, we both didn't quite get the second part of your question.
Okay, so instead of an inclusion list...
Yes.
Use it as an exclusion list.
Yeah.
And try and see what proteins or peptides you identify. Possibly you may be able to identify novel post-translational modifications using this technique.
Yeah. So you can certainly, the system allows you, so you refer to the rolling inclusion list to target the mass spectrometer features that have not been detected before. So you can use that however you want. You can certainly exclude peptides, you can include peptides, and there's many ways you can use that. So what you suggest is certainly a good idea. I mean, for instance, we can look first at these maps and say we would like to find, so this superhidden algorithm, for instance, supports a filter process on these maps and says, show me every pair of peaks which are, let's say, 80 mass units apart. And then it would, which would indicate possibly phosphorylation. And then you could write into the inclusion list those pairs, and it would should then give you the phosphor dephosphor form. So things like that you can certainly do. Yeah.
This is sort of a speculation question. From the standpoint of analytical chemistry, you would like to be able to analyze all network components and all of their phosphorylation states. From the standpoint of designing a therapeutic cellular product or a tissue, it might be sufficient to define a sufficient number of the network components to establish what a network scientist would call an attractor basin. Can you comment on whether you think that might be a likely thing to be able to do?
Yes, so I think that's actually a very good idea, and we hope to... So what I'm kind of imagining, which we actually try to implement in yeast, is kind of a zoom, like a goal-term zoom, that we would have as... So the bottom line is, even with this targeted mass spectrometry method, we cannot detect in every experiment the whole proteome. Maybe eventually that will be possible, but we cannot. Right now, the unit is about 300 proteins. So what we attempt to do is, I think what you suggest, that we would have modules which say over many conditions, these modules always go together, so there's no point of measuring all the elements of that module. So for instance, ribosome might be an example where you say, why measure every ribosome or protein? Maybe one or two is sufficient, then you know what the ribosome does. So that's exactly what we try to do. And then you could kind of zoom in and say, well, first you would do a large area on high goal term and say, which area is changing, and then you could zoom in there with a different set of proteins, yeah.
I'd like to take the opportunity to thank our speaker again and invite you all to attend a reception in the main hall. Thank you.